bigger. This is a way for really for us to try and communicate what's happening right across the sector, and it has been historically, I think this has come into being because the practice is so diverse. It's been very difficult for people to get a sense of what's going on across the country in terms of policy and practice and research. So we're trying hard to sort of bring that into a central hub. We just relaunched our website, which I'll come to in a moment, and we have a Twitter account. Please follow us on Twitter. So this was a slightly different looking slide. I thought I'd just talk you through how we're structured so that you get a sense of how we function. We have a steering group which is made up of regional representatives from around the country. So in each region of the country, we have a LENS representative, and Gillie Angel's here, who's the sort of driving force behind that LENS group. And that group is made up of people who have lived experience of the impact of culture and creativity on their own health and well-being. And they have regional representatives around the country who buddy with our own regional reps who are, we have one arts rep and one museums rep in each of the 9 English regions. The idea behind this, just ignore that slide, it looks terrible. The idea behind this is that it gives us access to what's really happening at a grassroots level so that we don't drift away from the actual practice on the ground and become a kind of quango that doesn't relate to what people are doing. So we have this regional structure, but complementing that, we've got a series of other partnerships that allow us to tie in with more national organisations. Again, ignore the slide. It used to have shapes. It was really nice, but now it's just bits of text. Never mind. So we have a Strategic Alliance Partners Group, which is quite a small group. The Arts Council sits on that group, and so does Public Health England, NHS England. And that's there to think about sort of top-level policy developments, how we can tie in with things like the NHS plan to make sure that cultural activity is kind of mapping onto that, and similarly that commissioners are aware of the kinds of cultural activity that might help them fulfil things like the personalisation agenda. And then we have another group of Strategic Alliance members, which is national organisations like Museums Association, Paintings and Hospitals, Live Music Now. I'm sure lots of you are familiar with those organisations. Some of you may be Strategic Alliance members. That group meets fairly regularly. And it's a way, again, for us to sort of keep in touch with what people are actually doing, how the larger national organisations are functioning, how they're bringing health and well-being and the arts and culture together. And we also have relationships with the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Arts, Health and Wellbeing. That was the group that produced the Creative Health Report that I referred to earlier on, which has an ongoing, very important strategic role in keeping this agenda at the fore in Parliament. So, at the moment, as I said, we've got this website, which I'm going to show you now. So this was launched in March, and I'm mentioning it because we're a very resource-light organisation. It's 2 part-time members of staff, but what we do have is this wide network of organisations that we're trying to link up, and the website is going to be a central part of that, obviously, as it is for a lot of our organisations. So we would like this to become the central resource for people who are interested in this work, but it is still very new, so I would really appreciate your feedback on this website, not necessarily at this moment, but generally, if you have time after this session to have a look at it to see whether you think it's providing anything useful to you, particularly the resources section, which is I think probably needs the most work. That's where we can house things like toolkits, evaluation, case studies, research, all of the things that are going to be helpful if you want to get into the nitty-gritty of arts, culture, health and well-being. So, yes, do please, this is an alliance of many different interests, and we'd really love to hear if this is fulfilling the needs that you have in relation to this area. So, what else? The website. We have a collection on that website of stories, which has come partly through the LENS group from people who have experienced the impact of culture and creativity on their own health and wellbeing, and that is another quite a useful resource. I don't think I've got any pictures of that. No, I haven't. We're also, at the moment, working on a response to the NHS long-term plan. I talked about that a couple of seconds ago, but essentially, has anybody read the NHS long-term plan? Any hands? significantly less people, not surprisingly. It's a bit of a monster document, but it is actually quite good news in many ways, because it is talking about the shift from, I guess, the medical model that has been under some scrutiny for a long time now, towards something that is much more responsive to individual needs, that is much more about the social model of health, if you like. And it opens a door for culture and creativity that hasn't been opened before, but it doesn't overtly mention either of those things. So our job as an alliance is to sort of map onto that document in a way that's going to be helpful to commissioners, so that they can understand how we're already doing the things that are being described in the NHS plan, but that may not have filtered into the generality of sort of health practice. And we're very interested in this interface between research and practice, which I guess is where the people in this room may be most, it may be most relevant to you. So historically, Helen will talk more about this because she's obviously got a huge experience of research. I have a kind of mixed background in research and practice. I've worked a lot in the medical humanities as well as in arts, culture and health. And I think there's a lot more that we could do to make sure that research is accessible to practitioners, and similarly that researchers are aware of the complexities of work on the ground, and to think about how we can frame this work in different sort of theoretical lenses. Some of you may have been at our conference. Did anybody come to that? Yay! That's nice to see. So this was... say that again. Yes, Julie did start, tried to start a conga at the end, which was, I was quite tired by then. So I wasn't perhaps as responsive as I could have been. That was one of the most terrifying moments of the whole conference. But it's the beginning of a process for us. We're a young organisation, but it was quite a buzzy space, I think. And it was held at the Tynemere Archives and Museums in Newcastle. For those of you that are familiar with them, they have a very strong health and wellbeing programme that's built into their structure and strategy. So we will be having these conferences annually. It's a way for us to really bring together people coming from a huge range of disciplines and to try and, not necessarily to build a coherent voice, but to allow for the diversity of voices in the space and find a way of presenting that. Presenting that diversity, I think. Oops, I've talked about. So, at that point, I'm going to hand over to Helen, who will talk a little bit more about the research side of things and the relationship with museums practice.
Thank you. Thanks, Victoria. So just a little bit of background. So I was one of the co-founders of the National Alliance for Museums, Health and Wellbeing, and the driver. We were also funded by Arts Council, and the National Alliance for Arts, Health and Wellbeing, which some of you may have been members of, people were members of the National Alliance for Arts, Health and Wellbeing, or LAF, London Arts Health and One or two? Yes, a few. And so we had always planned to set up in practice and work together. And I suppose my role really in all of this has been thinking about, because I come from a university's background and I'm an academic, was thinking really about how we can bring those voices together. My background is that I ran a museum for 10 years at UCL and was right opposite the hospital, and first started thinking about this because I started working closely with Guy Noble, who's the arts curator at the hospital. And at the time that we started doing our work, around 10 years ago, museums, the museum sector really wasn't doing work, very much work in this area, because it had a really big kind of knowledge and education focus. But museums were really, really interested in getting involved more in health and wellbeing. So it was a massive benefit to me and the kind of museum community to be able to engage with a huge wealth of knowledge across arts and health through things like LAF and the National Alliance for Arts, Health and Wellbeing. So in terms of research, I mean, really, as Victoria says, the best place to start is the Creative Health Report. So Rebecca Gordon-Nesbitt, who led on that, she did a huge amount of both desk-based work and also engaging with many of us across the research community and universities and lots of different arts and cultural organisations to build that evidence base. And please do have a look at it if you've not seen it. You can download it from the APPG for Arts and Health website, just Google Creative Health. There's over 1,000 references in there, and that just tells you the plethora of evidence that there is around arts and health. The challenge for somebody like me, who's interested in evidencing the impact of arts and culture on health, is how we can evidence that impact and what evidence means to different people. So when I say how, I mean, for example, things like what we measure, how we measure it and what sorts of questions we ask. So that's really where my research has been focused for around 10 years. Because I'm a biologist, I have a kind of biopsychosocial, which means I look at the kind of the whole person, both the biological, the physical, but also the psychological. And you can't do that really without thinking about the social context. So I've been interested in this from the perspective of valuing culture. So how is culture valued? For me, it's particularly around community assets, like museums, but also because I have a kind of natural sciences background, thinking beyond arts and cultural organisations through to nature and other community assets like parks and leisure spaces. And we do our research from the perspective of both individuals right through to populations. And a lot of our focus has been around methods. And that's really because when I first started working in this area, and I'm going to exemplify this with a particular research project, and that's the best way to explain the kind of research that we do, was really this challenge around how do we collect this type of evidence. And that's why I say keep going back to the Creative Health Report, because you'll really see there are a whole range of different types of evidence. And evidence means something different to lots of different people, whether you're a commissioner or whether you're a scientist or whether you're an artist. But it's also collected in different ways. So it's valued and collected in different ways. So we've been quite interested in those different sorts of methods, and we always use a kind of mixed approach. So we use both quantitative stuff that is more from a kind of science or clinical background through to very qualitative methods, right through to more creative methods by working with artists. And as Victoria said, I'm also really interested in what these sort of interfaces are, and we've really tried to build that into the alliance, those interfaces between research, practice and policy. So I chair the Culture, Health and Wellbeings and our strategic alliance partnership with people in NHS and PHE and Arts Council. And that's really where we're interested in your feedback on those kind of regional through to national translational activities. So, for example, how do we operationalise this stuff? How can we get CCGs, individual practitioners, individual GPs, for example, more engaged with understanding what it is that we do, but also understanding these challenges, for example, around evidence, which has been, to some extent, where some of those barriers in terms of understanding the value in the health and wellbeing sphere have arisen. So our model of working is really, it's impossible to do this work without collaboration and co-production and co-creation. And hopefully I'll show that today through the lens of one particular project. I apologise to anybody in advance if you've heard me talking about museums on prescription before. I feel like I'm talking a lot about it at the minute. That's just because social prescribing is just massive. Has everybody heard of social prescribing? Anybody not familiar with social prescribing? So this was really a project looking at the concept of museums on prescription. And when we first started this project 3 years ago, again, museums really didn't have any kind of formalised relationships around social prescribing, although many, many were already working around the social prescribing agenda, but not calling it social prescribing. Just to flag up that the Social Prescribing Network, which is the national network, a little bit like the Alliance, is linked with the Alliance, and each of our regional alliance leads are linked with the regional social prescribing network leads. So it really is worth tapping into your regional leads, because they can sort of link you in to the sorts of partnerships you might be interested in, and also finding out what's happening in your area. So back to our project, we were really interested in the concept of social prescribing in relation to museums and how museums could build sustainable relationships with referrers. As you can see here, possibly from the logos, we worked with many different kinds of referrers. So we worked with referrers in the local authority from organisations like adult social care and psychological services, through to NHS Trust, through to third sector organisations like local branches of AGK or Camden Carers, or a great organisation, if you don't know them, just down the road, the Claremont Project. And what they did is identify people in the community that they felt were most in need. And we decided in this project to focus on isolated older adults. That's essentially because in the areas where we were working, that is what those organisations felt was the greatest need, people who were isolated and who were older. And what those organisations did is they identified people and referred them on to a programme in our partner museums. I don't know how clearly you can see that. We work with a whole range of different museums. So we work with big national museums like the British Museum, through to small local authority museums like Canterbury's local museum, which is now called the Beanie House of Art and Knowledge. And we were not prescriptive at all what those museums did in those sessions. What we asked them to do is organise a minimum of 10-week programme lasting 2 hours a week, which sort of mirrored the kind of activities that museums were doing anyway when they're doing in-reach or outreach activities. And we asked them to co-produce that 10-week programme with those participants and their carers and also, where possible, those referrers, so that we were building a kind of genuine kind of partnership programme. That whole setting up of that programme took a year. So what we would advise in terms of the Alliance is really, when you're thinking about, if you're new to this area of work or you're looking to expand your work, is really to plan in that partnership working a long time in advance, because it takes a long time to build those relationships and understand what those different stakeholders might need from that particular partnership. So people did a whole range of different stuff. Sessions lasted 2 hours, about 2 hours, and happened every week for 10 weeks. We hoped that they would continue beyond the 10 weeks, but what we were doing was researching the impact of those activities for the people referred to that programme, but also all of those different stakeholders. So we spent a lot of time thinking about what kinds of research to do and what kind of research questions, but in particular, what kind of methods to undertake. And I'm not going to spend huge amounts of time because I haven't got that much time today. So if you want to know more, there's loads of stuff on our website and loads of publications, and I brought a few copies with me today which give you further information about the research. But we basically used, as I say, a mixed method. So we always use quantitative and qualitative. We spend a lot of time thinking about what kind of measures to use. We were explicitly asked by our, particularly our clinical partners, that we had to use a some clinically validated measures. So we chose to use the Warwick Edinburgh Mental Wellbeing Scale, which is quite widely used, and a scale dedicated to isolation and loneliness, the UCLA Loneliness Scale. And we also co-developed our own museum wellbeing measure, which I'll talk about in a second. And what we did is we did a what's called a standard experimental psychology approach. We collected data at the beginning of week one, at week five, at week 10, and then in follow-up after 3 and 6 months. And that's really just a standard way to look at the changes that people go through over time across a programme. I said I'd mention about our wellbeing measure. I'm not going to go into huge amounts of detail, but when we first started this research, we were looking really across the social prescribing research interface and really couldn't find very good models for how to test social prescribing. I haven't described it here, but we did a survey of about 100 different social prescribing projects. Over half of those were not evaluated at all. Most of them were evaluated only at the end of the programme using very, very small sample sizes, using a qualitative methodology. Very few were quantitative, and very few had a standardised model that we could easily adopt. And that's been the case for us for every different different intervention or activity that we've tried to evaluate. And that's really the background to why we decided to develop our own measure. We worked with about 15 different museums across the UK and 200 of their participants who essentially co-produced this. And it's based on something called the positive effect, negative effect scale. And participants essentially wanted something a little bit more creative as a way to collect quantitative data. So what you can see is different positive words and different negative words, and people simply rate those words on a scale of 1 to 5. So again, if you're interested in knowing more, there's details on our website. So what does that give you? Well, what that gives you across a 10-week programme is data that looks a bit like this. I'm not going to go through it. But what you can see on the left-hand side in light colour is the baseline from the base of week one, so how people rate themselves in terms of positive emotions and negative emotions at the beginning of week one, right through to then in the darker blue colour, the same rating at the end of week 10. And what that shows us is that we see a statistically significant increase in people's perceptions of their psychological well-being from the beginning of the programme to the end of the programme. So that's nice. We can say people's psychological well-being is improved. Brilliant. We can even look at different words associated with that that people value more about those sessions. So that's great. We get loads of nice quantitative data. We didn't get very nice quantitative data when we've used Warwick Edinburgh Mental Wellbeing Scale and the Loneliness Scale. If anybody else has ever had any experience of WebWEMS, it'd be nice to hear from you. We've used it many, many times and never with any success. Most of our participants really, really struggled with it. We were working with a lot of people with a various range of cognitive disorders. They had macular degeneration, they may not have had English as a first language, and many of them refused to fill out the measure because they found it too invasive or they didn't understand the questions. And we had the same problem with the isolation scale. And this has been one of the things that's fascinated us and driven our research, really, is the challenges of using that kind of medical model in a non-clinical activity or intervention like a creative activity. I'd be interested in anybody else has had experience of that. So really the most insightful area of our research has been around the sort of qualitative end of the spectrum. And we use a whole range of different methodologies, from diary, reflexive diary keeping. Our participants came up with the idea of a museum passport. All of our participants were people who were not active arts and culture users. Most of them were entirely restricted to their own homes, apart from going to medical appointments. They were not museum users. Most of them did not see museums as a place to go, or indeed any kind of arts activity as a place to go to reduce isolation, to increase improve your mood, improve psychological well-being. So they came up with the idea of a passport because they liked the idea of being able to give them permission to go into the museum and do cool stuff. And a similar sort of idea, but the diaries were kept by the people running the sessions. We all kept diaries, and then all of those different stakeholders also kept diaries. And we did interviews with all of those different participants and stakeholders throughout the process. And that, as you can imagine, gives us huge amounts of really, really rich data, and I won't go through all of those different methods that we use to analyse those data. But what that enabled us to do was essentially come up with the main outcomes that we found from this study, which help us to kind of articulate impact in a much more nuanced way. And what was great is this has really helped us to understand better about what works in a programme, what doesn't work, and what is valued by those participants and by those different stakeholders. And I won't run through all of these, but the idea that for this community who've never worked together before and started working together on a two-weekly basis in a new space where they've never have gone before, that this helped to build this idea of sense of belonging. I'm sure many of you who are involved in these sorts of projects have the same sorts of finding. So things like improving quality of life were commonly cited or articulating similar sorts of outcomes. A really big part of these activities, particularly we found for museum activities, is this idea of learning and acquiring new skills. And we know that's important throughout life, but particularly in later life, where you still have huge amounts of brain plasticity, even for some of our participants who have early or mid-stage dementia. Really important, that idea of social activity, so having something positive and meaningful to go to, so having something to look forward to, that actually really cannot be underestimated. So what we started finding is participants would say, I'm sure many of you have had this if you run these sorts of activities, they were actually preferring to come to their museum sessions than going to a clinical appointment, and were sometimes rearranging clinical appointments. And you've heard stories about how GPs are often the place where people who are lonely and isolated at all stages of their life go. And GPs are often thinking about what's going on in their surgery and why are they seeing repeats. The same happened to my dad. He was in his GPs every single week, sometimes multiple times a week, with complex health problems, which are usually a mix of psychological and physical. And that's, I think, where the benefit of these sorts of activities can really come in, because we're offering a very kind of mixed, multi-sensory, interactive, socially engaging and creative activities. And I think that's really the best way for me, that when I articulate what the benefits of arts and culture are to health. What was really nice is this group started then to meet regularly. Some of the museums did carry on weekly activities or segued participants into new programmes. And all of that definitely led to healthier lifestyle changes. And I think the really important thing to come out of all this is the importance of having sustained activities. Many of us, due to project funding limitations, work on this project basis of a six-week programme or a 10-week programme. And what we really find is that people who engage in activities regularly, that's where you're going to see medium and long-term changes. So what I've described here are short-term changes. What we really need is the sorts of longitudinal data that is very hard to collect because it's very expensive. But that's where we know you're going to have the biggest type of lifestyle changes, and I think that we can offer the biggest amount of impact. And that's really where we hope the Alliance will start to come in to start making those sorts of recommendations about how you might strategically operate differently to be able to sustain programmes, perhaps through partnerships, so the pressure isn't just on you as an individual or an organisation to run those activities every week, for example, but that through partnership working, you can offer a programme that supports people in your community or particular people with particular needs on a long-term basis, so that you can build those really sustained and engaged relationships. So as I say, there's loads of stuff about that research and our other research about social prescribing on our website. And if you want to know more about any of those things, then do give me a shout in the coffee break. And just to finish off, because I know we're running out of time, this is just a project we got funded last year. It's a 1.25 million project from the UK Research an innovation fund, and it's really about community assets. So I've talked about those before, and what we're really interested in is about community assets and mental health. We're going to be giving away small-ish pots of money to get organisations working with academics to look at what the challenges and opportunities and evidence and also evidence gaps are around community assets like arts organisations and museums, but also green spaces in relation to mental health. So please do join us. We call the March Network. You can just Google us, March Mental Health Network, and it's free to join again. That's me.
Thank you.
Over to you, Eva.
Thank you so much, Helen. And we will come back and talk about all of this anon. But before, because I know Richard is sort of in and out really this afternoon, so over to you now, Richard. Richard Ings from Arts Council, and thank you too so very much.
Thank you. Great to hear from the Culture Health and Wellbeing Alliance. Glad to say that they're now part of the national portfolio, and we're working together with them on this extraordinary area.
Can you say what the national portfolio is for people in the room who don't know?
Yes, the national portfolio are organisations that we offer longer term funding for. So the current investment round is 4 years. So they're organisations that have some sustained funding from us. I think it's very hard to overstate the significance of what's happening in this field at the moment. Two examples of that from two meetings I've had over the last 2 days. I've just jumped in a taxi from a meeting with a cross-government meeting talking about social prescribing. And sitting around the table were the DCMS, the NHS, Public Health England, Department of Work and Pensions, DEFRA, the DfE, Transport, Health Education England, and so on and so on, and the Arts Council. And that's looking at one of the major outcomes of the one of the major planks, five planks, if you like, of the NHS long-term plan, which is around social prescribing. And obviously the Arts Council is very interested to see the arts and culture as part of that programme. And there's lots of questions, there's lots of concerns. A lot of government money at the moment seems to be going towards the link workers, those people that are between the whoever's prescribing, whether it's the GP, social care, whatever, and the cultural organisation. We need to decide where we can make a significant contribution as the Arts Council. And that's a bit of a theme. I'll come on to a little bit more about the Arts Council itself, but just wanted to say about another meeting I had yesterday at the Welcome Collection with one of the organisations that I work with a lot called Heart and Soul. Do anyone knows Heart and Soul's work with
yes.
people with learning disabilities? Pioneering, a visionary organisation, really, been celebrated its 30-year anniversary last year. Yeah. And it was the first arts-led project that has secured the Welcome Hub. And the Hub is a 2-year programme. It's based on the fifth floor of the Welcome Collection opposite Euston Station. They'll be doing public events, and they have done public events, so worth keeping an eye on what's happening there. But they're a very interesting organisation because they bring people with learning disabilities into their, they're part of their board. They were co-founded between Mark Williams, the director, and Pino, who's got learning difficulties. They bring them along to funding meetings. They brought them along to the very rigorous interview they were given by the Wellcome Trust to see if they were amongst, they were six shortlisted projects, and all, as in the past, were, apart from Heart and Soul, were led by academics with arts organisations as part of their team. So it was clear from talking to the Wellcome that before this happened, that this was probably the biggest risk, you know, if they gave the gig to them, because there is a sense that research is rigorous, robust, and all the rest of it. Heart and Soul tends to go its own way and work in an organic way, as many organisations do in this field, actually, that I'm involved with. You might know IntelliKey, there's a whole range of them, I think, and across the country, of course. So, now I've lost my thread.
Welcome.
I mean, I think, yes, Welcome. And I thought it was wonderful, because Welcome can use its money in a very specific, discretionary way, in the way that the Arts Council really can't, because we are open to anyone who wants to do anything to do with art in England, in any direction, so we get it from all directions. But the Welcome, I thought, took a really good risk there, because that's what surely research is about. It's about exploration, and that's an organisation that works in an exploratory way. You know, we struggle to ask for smart targets or KPIs or whatever, and luckily they said they don't have those at the Wellcome. Mm-hmm. So it's a discovery, and I'm bringing them in a bit because one of the things they're going to be evaluating is well-being, and not just well-being of the people they're working with, but the well-being of the people doing that work with them. You know, and the impact on the artists and the cultural practitioners is often overlooked in this work as well. So that's just two meetings, and I think I've called this a little spiel a happier and more creative society ? And I think that link between happiness and creativity is really strong. I think you could make an argument, well, I would make the argument that the biggest case that you can make for the arts is that it contributes to well-being. You know, the smallest thing, going to play in the West End, you come out, you're stimulated, you're angry, you have a sort of a gut reaction to it, you have an emotion, you have a social experience. So I think there is that link which needs to be, you know, looked at more and thought about more when we look at investing money and energies. So practice, research and policy, as we've said already, you know, those are all interlinked. They're a virtuous circle. And I'm constantly arguing that people that are working with organisations, cultural organisations, museums and libraries and so on, that they have the opportunity to feedback what they're learning from the sector back to the people that are making research and making policy at the Arts Council and elsewhere. And similarly, those developing policy and research ideas at the Arts Council feedback with the programme, strategic programmes and directions, feed that back. So you've got a virtuous circle. So you've got... These are all overlapping things, of course. You could talk about practice-based research. Some of the most exciting research is around that. You could talk about evidence-based policy. A lot of people do that. Research-informed practice. There's a lot of interesting, reflective work going on amongst cultural organisations. Think about what they do. They don't often have the resources to do it. They don't often, very rarely, I mean, it's true of the voluntary sector as a whole. I don't think there's a lot of money out there for independent evaluation, never mind full-scale research, never mind randomised controlled trials. Which is what the which I come on to, which is what we think healthcare and criminal justice sectors are looking for. I say criminal justice because I've been looking at that as well. What's interesting again about that meeting I had today was that social prescribing is being rolled out universally. It's part of the 10-year plan. Where's the evidence? There isn't actually a lot of evidence. Public Health England is actually producing in a month or two a rapid evidence review, which many of you will be familiar with. But she's saying there's no big surprises there. The evidence is still quite unclear. Yet they're going ahead with it, which suggests that something else is going on there, that research is not the only thing. It's an important thing, but it's not the only thing that's happening here. There's a sense that, oh, yeah, we can see it's happening. I mean, those of us that have been involved in participatory arts, community arts back in the day, now socially engaged arts, we know, we can see it happen. Proving it is more difficult. In those hard, robust terms that we've come to expect to be asked for by the healthcare sector and so on. So I think I just want to talk a little bit about how we support those three activities, research, policy and practice. In our current strategic framework, we've got a 10-year plan or strategy that ends in March next year. So did anybody of you know that the Arts Council is consulting on its next 10-year strategy? Could I have hands? Right, well, you all know now. And before I forget to say this, in June, the last iteration, to use that awful word, the last iteration of this policy will be published, and you will have an opportunity to say, okay, Arts Council, we see what you're saying. What does this mean about that? Have you thought about that? There's still time to do that, because we're now looking at... We've got the broad pattern outlined, but we don't. The devil will be in the detail. How do we actually implement that policy? Looks like arts and health might well be part of it. There's a groundswell of support from it from our executive board. There's a huge amount of work happening, which is one of the things that's been going on almost behind our backs, because for the last few years, for all sorts of reasons and excuses we could make, cuts. You know, 30% cuts to Arts Council funding a decade ago. we had taken, to be honest, we had taken our eye off the ball. Our decision making hasn't been consistent and coherent, in my view. So what we did a couple of years ago, what the executive board did then, was initiate a scoping project, which I led, looking at what we'd done in this area, what we'd invested in it, what we'd said about the work, whether we were still having conversations, as we did have over a decade ago with the Ministry of Justice, NHS, Department of Health, and so on. We did have policies and strategies and programs around that. And then looking, were we still doing those things, and to what level? What could we do more proactively in future? And it's in part response to the sector itself. I mean, the alliances in museums and the arts were driving that agenda. London Arts and Health Forum in London, Arts and Health South West. These were people that kept it going. And I came back into the sector at a conference two and a half years ago in Bristol. I was just stunned by the amount of stuff going on internationally and in this country. I mean, we are still among the leaders, if not the leader, in this area of work. So the Arts Council ought to wake up to that fact. And in fact, our Chief Executive, Darren Henley, gave the first speech of a CEO of the Arts Council for about 8 years, I think, at the recent World Health Federation conference in Manchester. So I think we're on course for a strategy that will really take this seriously and articulate it properly, and hopefully give you people who want to apply for funding more guidance as to what we're looking for. There's lots of questions around it. You know, a lot of people out there I know have not applied to the Arts Council because they think we're looking for a great exhibition or a great show. That's not necessarily the case. We're looking for other kinds of outcomes. We're looking to explore what quality means in this regard. So we have these kind of three roles then, as an investor or funder, as an advocate, and as an influencer strategist. And we have never stopped funding this work. Let's be clear about that. We never stopped saying it's a good thing. Our comms teams have highlighted stories on a fairly regular basis, including around loneliness, arts and loneliness, and different projects. But we're now working towards a much more coherent approach to it. Certainly around having a bigger story to tell and why we're supporting this work. It is very, as well as being a hugely, it goes along with expanding and dynamic nature of the field, that it's an alphabet universe, really. I mean, CCGs and STPs and ISOs and TWAs and LAFs and all the rest of it. And negotiating our way around that is the other part of our work, is where do we sit? You know, if we took all our Arts Council money and threw it at, say, Arts on Prescription, you know, where has it gone? Yeah. You know, because it's a vast and potential extraordinary development, but our money won't go very far. So where can we put our money strategically in partnership? And that partnership is really, really important, which is why that meeting today was so interesting. All these different government departments thinking, how can we make this work? Okay, so what we do in practice, obviously we fund organisations, and organisations that may have a specialist role in this area, like Hoot Arts, or the sector support organisations. We fund organisations that then do their health and well-being projects or programmes. We fund artists to work in hospital settings. If you look at that taxonomy, the list of things that you could call arts and health, it's about a dozen ways you can talk about arts and health, you know, in medical settings, in the community. Artists being inspired by the work of surgeons to create exhibitions. It's a multifarious field, and my argument at the Arts Council is that if you want to have great art, you put an artist in these situations, or a cultural practitioner in these situations, of working with a group living with dementia, or working in a prison cell, that practice is going to shift, and extraordinary art can emerge, actually, from it. If you're really concerned, as the Arts Council say we are, about diversity and engagement with a broader audience, not just servicing the same people, the same monocultural body of middle-class people, but broadening that out, what more diverse audience could you have, or participants could you have, than those people that are needing health provision? people in hospitals. You have thousands of people through the doors of hospitals and so on. So policy, as I've suggested, I think there's a lot going on, and the Arts Council is trying to get in on everything, every round table there is. We're there at the Manhattan COP round table. We're there around, our CEO, he's doing really well at the moment. He was at the knife crime round table last week that Theresa May called as a break from Brexit. But that was, seriously, that was a really important moment. And that, again, does refer, that's a public health issue. And there is a CCG in London, Tower Hamlets, that's already doing work about linking social prescribing, arts on prescription, to youth violence and knife crime. So that's all really exciting. So we are now talking to the major stakeholders, but we're also conscious that this kind of work really happens best when it's place-based, if you like, that sort of trendy term at the moment still, probably. But it's about, if social prescribing is going to work of any kind, it's got to be about relationships, and it's got to be about local needs. And it's about local assets. We heard about a little bit about the March Network, the mental health, very exciting, lots of different projects in it, but this major arts and culture, isn't it? It's about, and that's really looking at how can we support people with mental health issues through maximising our local resources, or the other phrase that's used a lot is asset-based working. And some of our most progressive work that we directly fund, such as Creative People and Places, is very similar to that kind of work and to the way Public Health England now works in asset-based, locally-based working. So this has got to happen not just in London roundtables, but it's got to happen all around the country. It is already happening, of course. So there's some shining examples of this work, some of them sparked off by funding from the Arts Council, such as through their cultural commissioning programme, because... Am I running out of time?
You're okay. You've got 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Yeah. I haven't talked about my research report, have I? No. Yes, no. Okay. I've talked a little bit about policy, a little bit about practice. There's a huge amount. So, I mean, I could spend an afternoon talking about all the amazing projects and artists I've been meeting over the last couple of years. I mean, it's quite extraordinary work. But one thing I did at the end of my national scoping, I was asked at fairly short notice to produce a summary of the evidence of the impact of arts and culture on health and well-being and on criminal justice work. And
it's really useful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that. Well, I felt a bit of an amateur, to be honest, because just going out there and just... I mean, we had a lot of papers to look at. I mean, if you were going to do this job properly, you'd need 2 years, probably. There's tens of thousands of papers on arts and health. But I tried to pull out... in this report, the kind of main themes and the main gaps. I'm just going to read a little bit if I've got time. This is a report that's actually on our website. It's called, if you can find things on our website, it's called, if you put it, Health and Wellbeing Summary of Evidence or something, but I can send a link via Georgia. What became clear, because what I was asked to look at is what the evidence says, and a lot of the evidence... both for criminal justice and for the health, it is based on this golden measure of the randomised controlled trial, or the experimental method. Qualitative work is somewhere down here. Mixed methods is down here. Practice-based is... But that's being challenged. That's not least by the cultural value report and the centre that's been created from that. It's challenged not least by the academic community itself, which is doing some really exciting work in terms of practice-based mixed methods approaches to research. From the Arts Council point of view, and I'll finish with this, I think there's a big thing missing. I mean, apart from, which is the creative and cultural element of it all, because a lot of, and the Creative Health Report is absolutely brilliant. There's a wonderful book by Dr. Daisy Fancourt called Arts and Health, which I don't know if you know, but you must read. It's essential. But a lot of that, understandably, is really about health outcomes. Whether that's through arts therapy or through arts in health. Now, that's a distinction you might want to ask about later. I'm not going to go into it now. But not to say that all those people are not absolutely dedicated and supportive of arts and culture in those sectors. But what about, from an Arts Council point of view, our question might be different. Our question might be, what are the creative and cultural outcomes of this work? I think I'll probably stop there, actually, rather than chunk out. But I'll open to questions, obviously.
Thank you so much, Richard. That's really great. And I know, but you have to leave quite soon.
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't?
No, I don't. No, no.
Sorry, I thought you were telling me that you needed to go. So, oh, right, I'm
pleased
you can stay, because I was going to say you're not going until we ask you some questions, but as you're staying...
No, I'm going to stay.
That's fine. Thank you so much, Richard.
I think I've now got two mics in my hand.
Stereo.
But I think now, if I can hand over to you, Jane, to say a few words about what's going on in the city, and using the city really as a case study, I believe you're talking about.
Thanks, Evelyn, and thank you very much for inviting me to be here today. It's fantastic to see so many people in the room, and slightly intimidating. So I'm here to talk a little bit about a project in progress, really. I'm based down in Brighton. My name is Jane McMorrow, and I am director of an organisation called Creative Future. And if you can indulge me for 2 minutes, I want you to tell you a little bit about that, because it's a great organisation. We're an arts organisation and a charity. We're in the business of working with underrepresented artists, and really to, you know, a mission to make the arts more diverse and more representative of the world that we live in. So we work with a huge number of people who have mental health issues. And we run a big national competition for underrepresented writers, as well as a significant programme of workshops around the country. It's great to hear feedback from those people that come onto the course and say to us, 6 weeks on this writing course, finding my voice has been done more for me than a year of therapy. And I think that is sort of evidence in itself of the impact of some of the work that organisations like Creative Future are delivering. Anyway, I do that, but I'm not here to talk about that today. I'm actually here to talk about my role as co-chair of the Living Well Group, which is part of an emerging cultural framework for Brighton and Hove, and that's managed by the Arts and Creative Industries Commission. It's a bit slightly complicated. Brighton Hove, I'm sure you've all been there at some point, is known internationally as a hotbed of creativity. It's at the epicentre of one of the most dynamic and innovative creative clusters in the UK, at the forefront of advances in artificial intelligence and augmented reality, as well as being home to hundreds of artists and creative producers. But despite its distinctiveness, the city does face a number of significant challenges, some shared with other UK cities, of course, such as the impact of Brexit. I thought I was going to be the first person to mention that, but Richard beat me to it. Growing inequality and problems connected to an ageing population, and some caused by its unique geography, including relatively low productivity and very limited physical space for new houses or workplaces. So the cultural framework for Brighton and Hove is a shared plan of action. So this is really, I'm responding to a city-wide response to the arts, health and wellbeing agenda, if you like, and what we're looking at and what we can do to respond to that. It's a collaborative process. It involves hundreds of local people and is an ongoing process to address the things that hold Brighton back, whether it is addressing inclusion, creating more opportunities for young people to get into creative employment, helping improve health and well-being, or ensuring that creativity is properly positioned as the driver of growth and inward investment. The plan for the cultural framework is to acknowledge that Brighton Hove needs to build on its track record as a bold first mover and ensure it continues to dare to be different. So to put that group in some kind of context, the framework has five separate groups, five unique ambitions, which provide a sort of framework for the ongoing actions. So the overall ambition for the Living Well Group is to become a nationally recognised centre of excellence for the use of culture in promoting well-being and addressing health inequalities. So quite an ambitious thing there, but you know, got to start at the top. And there's also the other areas that are rethinking our place, which is around developing best practice and co-production models for neighbourhoods with residents truly in the lead. The Brighton Experience, which is to be the best place in Britain to be a home worker or creative freelancer. Bursting the Bubbles, which is to be an irresistible magnet for creatives, audiences and investors. And Creative Coasts is around how we set up as a regional capital of creative productivity and spillover innovation. So art, as has been demonstrated, the arts, health and wellbeing agenda is a wide-ranging field of activity. There are as many ways in which the work is described as there are types of activity. So this really truly is a work in progress. The Living Well Group was established at the tail end of last year, and we had our first meeting in December 2018. At our meeting in February, we decided to change the name to the Arts, Health and Wellbeing Group. And at our next meeting in February, that will be agreed that that's our new name. We spent half of our last meeting debating the arts and culture thing. Should we be culture, health and wellbeing? Should we be arts, health and wellbeing? We decided to go with arts in the end. It's an ongoing discussion. I'm sure everyone is facing that. Yeah. It's an interesting one. But we went for arts in the end. And the purpose of the working group is to develop a strategic approach which will deliver outstanding results for the Living Well Strand objectives. And what will be involved? Well, that's it's all done on a voluntary basis. All our work is volunteers from the third sector, from the council, from the universities, turning up at meetings and investing in this strategy. People need to attend some meetings. They need to actively contribute. They need to support with tasks and activities and ensure that the Living Well Strand reaches its full potential. And who's in the working group? Lots of people, as I said, from the third sector, from the universities. And our aims for the Living Well Group are to develop opportunities for collaboration between the arts, culture sector and the health and wellbeing sector, and a shared approach to evaluating arts, health and wellbeing activity. To promote the contribution that cultural engagement makes to health and wellbeing, to target and coordinate the work of the cultural sector to address health and wellbeing priorities across the city, to develop cultural initiatives and schemes working in collaboration with the health and wellbeing sector that reduce inequality, improve access, and allow people to have choices and a say in what they are engaging with. And of course, the most important one, to seek investment to support the development and dissemination of good practice. I co-chair the group with the Director of Public Health for Brighton and Hove. He's quite new in the job. His first ever report, he was so inspired by the work that they were doing that he chose the theme of his report to be the art of good health. And I think that was completely acknowledging that we examined the strength of the evidence base in Brighton and Hove and found that there is strong evidence in some areas, but that more research is required in others. And I think that's, again, a theme that has come out today around the research needed, the evidence that is needed. The city's thriving cultural and academic centres represent two of its most prominent assets. So Brighton and Hove has the potential to be an international leader in research in this area. And although in many aspects we're getting healthier, this hasn't benefited everyone equally. For example, in Brighton and Hove, men in the most deprived areas can expect to live a decade less than those in the least deprived, while the gap for women is 6 years. However, many of those with the greatest health needs, such as older people and carers, engage less with the arts. Therefore, these inclusive and targeted approaches are required to reach those most in need. So the report, and I've got a few copies of the report if anyone would like one, and I also will give Georgia the link so that you can download it to have a look in your own time. These targeted approaches are required to reach those most in need. The report is structured around the life course through starting, living, aging and dying well, and those areas are outlined in the report. As I said, the Arts, Health and Wellbeing Group, it's a work in progress, as is this cultural framework. Maybe I could come back in a year's time and talk to you about some of the outcomes from the work that we've done. Our next step, the next thing we're going to do, is we have a provocation coming up. The title of that is More Culture, Less Medicine. It's being delivered in partnership with the University of Brighton, the Knowledge Exchange manager there, Stuart Headley, and his department, which is nicely called Creative Futures. So Creative Future and Creative Futures are actually coming together on this project, yes. And we're working with the University of Brighton and the RSA on delivering this provocation. And the question that we're going to put out for the provocation is, despite rapid advances in healthcare, we are living more years in ill health and can't treat our way out of this crisis. Health and arts practitioners from Brighton and Hove will lead a discussion on how the arts can provide a solution by creating arts and health opportunities for people and communities. And I'll leave you on that question.
Thank you so much, Jane, and a really good and lively provocation at the end there in particular. I hope we're going to pick up on that when we enter sort of the discussion phase. But finally, in this first session, delighted to hand over to you, Brian Bell from Central. And I just want to say, because I've forgotten to say this about everybody else, as the agendas are on the table, everyone else's sort of titles, but the title, I believe, of your provocation is It's Not Always You, It's Often Them. So I'm looking forward to this, Brian. Social justice in health and well-being. Over to you.
Can I just put this here? Is that okay?
Yeah.
I've just been taking some notes. Can you just, if it shuts down everything, we'll be fine. Can I use the microphone? Sorry, where did...
You can, okay. Sorry.
I'm very loud, but everyone should always use a microphone. So I have just closed a festival. We had a 3-day festival, the Sick of the Fringe, that was on at the Welcome, the Place in Camden People's Theatre. So this is my first day out. So anyone who works in arts and culture knows that first day out feeling. So I'm feeling a little bit of that. So thanks for having me. I wear a few different hats in the world. I'm an artist. I have my own practice as an artist. I co-curate and help to run the Sick of the Fringe. I'm an academic, so I work as the Knowledge Exchange Fellow at Central School of Speech and Drama. And the hat that I'm wearing kind of most these days is someone who is sad in the world and sad at the state of the world. So I'm bringing those here, and I was very moved by Jane's presentation because you seem to so eloquently talk about social injustice embedded inside of really smart, thoughtful business and policy, and I don't think I'm there yet because I just feel kind of generally sad about the state of the world. So if you get that, I hope that you take that energy for how I mean it to be, which is just, I don't think you can look at the world and not be deeply sad or upset about how many people are homeless on the street, how many trans kids are killing themselves, and the list goes on and on and on. So I've just been thinking about the last presentations and then adding my own thoughts. But one provocation that I'll make is, why are we evaluating and working towards evidence-based things when we are not living in a time when those in government necessarily use that evidence base? And I would like to see proof that evidence is leading decision-making processes, because I am just not convinced that it is, and I see the efforts of so many people, so many thousands and millions and hundreds of millions of pounds going towards evaluation when I'm not sure that they're being used. People don't care. They're going to do what they do, so I'm curious if we should be doing that also, or the artist in me just says, sweep it all away. I'm just not sure what the right answer is today. And that's in the UK as much as everywhere else in the world. You can hear my American accent. But I am naturalized as a British citizen, thank God, because this place is just perfect right now. The next provocation that I will add, which I'm always nervous about when there's someone from the Arts Council here, especially as I have a project in for consideration at the moment. I'm not sure it's an... I have dedicated my life and my practice to working particularly with young people with cancer, but I work with that as a starting point to deal with people with other illness, disability, etc. I think I do that because I had cancer when I was young, and I thought there were a lot of problems associated with the way I was treated and the way I interacted with the world. It formed the bone of my arts practice. So that's what I do. And the only thing I'm nervous about right now with the Arts Council and policy, etc., is that I fear that it is becoming our job to fix major social problems and major governmental problems. And like I said, I was like a person who saw a lot of problems with my cancer care and the way people talked about it. So that's why I wanted to make art. But I didn't go into art to enter an evidence-based kind of world where I had to prove to fix something gigantic. And I feel like it is increasingly a pressure on artists and on arts organizations to fix major problems. I was just at Great Ormond Street Hospital. I'm currently running a project there with Emily Underwood Lee, who's in Wales, a great artist in Wales. And we're doing a project on parents and self-care because actually Great Ormond Street Hospital doesn't have a remit to do art for parents, which is just an interesting equation. So we got Arts Council money, thank you so much, to create a project with them. And what's interesting about Great Ormond Street is that they kind of keep doing more to help young kids, you know, who are treated with them with very serious illnesses and disabilities and complex world-leading problems. And I always keep wondering, and they have got more social workers and they work in the community and they do all this. And at some point I've had to ask people, I say, well, where does it stop? Where does Great Ormond Street Hospital, for example, have to stop? Where do you have to stop and say, that's not our problem? We can only do what we can do, and someone else, the community, the world, the government has to take on from here. So I'm very much thinking all the time about where is it my job and where isn't it my job? Because there are only 24 hours in a day and there are only 7 days in a week. And there is not anyone who's working in arts and health who is not working way over what they're supposed to be doing and way over what they're paid to do. So I'm nervous that it's not an artist's job or an arts organization to fix major social problems, major governmental problems. It's the government's job not to traumatize people. That is not something that I mean as a joke. It is not the government's job. It is the government's job not to traumatize people. The bedroom tax, DWP, Brexit, everything has... Everything that we're seeing is the result of, whether it's this government or the last government, it doesn't matter. It's the government's job not to traumatize people. And we're seeing so much work being done to fix people traumatized by things that did not exist because we lived in nicer times. Whether those were 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 50 years ago, it is the government's job not to traumatize people. So I'm cynical sometimes if arts are used as a substitution for solving major health crises and political crises. I would have to work less with people who feel they're being underserved by community if the community could serve them better, instead of having to make art about that. I was really struck, Tania El-Khoury, I don't know if people know Tania El-Khoury's work. She's based sometimes here, sometimes in the States. So she did a beautiful work, which you can see the faint image on my arm about. She works with Basel Zara, a migrant to this country, a refugee. And they do this beautiful show where he talks about his journey. And he talked, as part of our festival, about the experience of people in isolation in detention centers, and people who come on a very difficult journey to this country. Now, we think this country, the conversation that has happened in this country is that migrants and refugees are overwhelming our NHS. But what Tanya said that I thought so beautiful, I'm just going to read her a little paragraph that she wrote as her art introduction. She says, "In As Far As My Fingertips Take Me," which is the name of her show, "we wanted to open up the conversation on the fact that what Europe calls a refugee crisis is first and foremost a crisis for the refugees themselves, one that was not merely born out of the Arab uprisings. In the case of Palestinians, for example, for more than 70 years, several generations have been born as refugees, living and waiting. In As Far As Isolation Goes, we aim to initiate much-needed conversation in the UK. Even though very few were allowed to seek, let alone receive, asylum in the UK, those who made it past this harsh border did not find a system of care waiting for them. We have seen friends and other inspiring artists and activists locked in detention centers, mental asylums, or forced into poverty." What she does that I love is that she says, it's not us, it's sometimes them. That's what I really, really appreciated about her work. So let me know if I ramble. I'm probably rambling. So I'm cynical, I'm nervous about that. So that was all what I just was thinking about while I was sitting here. Now I can get to my real notes that I prepared before. The greatest fallacy about health and well-being, illness and disability is that they are apolitical. I said it. That everyone can surely agree that everyone deserves to be healthy and happy and live a dignified life. My parents and I fight about this all the time. My parents love to support cancer charities because I had cancer. They think that it's great to support. And I said, well, because they live in the States, I said, well, if the US government just helped cancer patients, we wouldn't need to have all these cancer charities, right? We don't need to be super proud of having tons of food banks if we don't have a poverty problem, right? So like, these are the things. So, and I think that often arts and health is thought of as nice. And I am very cynical around nice. I don't want anyone to be nice to me. And I will get emotional for 1 second, although I'm very emotional all the time. That's my Americanness. Well, I've added a little bit more emotional to your population. So Catherine Araniello was an artist who passed away in February. And she, Catherine Araniello, which is A-R-A-N-I-E-L-L-O, was the forefront of saying the world should not be nice to people with disabilities. They should be just, and we have the right to be angry. She was like disgusting and awesome and wicked. Does anyone know her work here? Yeah, you know, if you know her, she was not nice. She was disruptive. She said, the Olympics, the Paralympics were not good for disabled people. They made them more seem like scroungers because they can't run that fast mile and they need PAs. So I definitely think you should look her up, but I'm against niceness. It's not nice why we do our work. We do our work, I think, as Jane talked about, as a question of justice. My work that I've been doing at Central, I'm sorry, I'm skipping around a little bit. At Central, I work with my colleagues there, particularly those in applied arts, in drama and applied arts program, to think of their work through a lens of social justice. They think that they're doing work on health, but they're really doing work on social justice, because the world is political and niceness gets us nowhere. We don't work with elders with dementia, as Nikki Abraham does, because she's nice. She doesn't do it because she's nice. She does it because ageism is a thing. And society has shunted older people for long enough. We don't support, as Kat Lowe does, women with HIV and AIDS with Positively UK because she is nice, but because stigma around being a woman with HIV and AIDS continues to cause serious anxiety and social isolation for those women. And we don't support kids in care, as Sylvan Baker's research does, because he is lovely or nice. It's because kids in care are treated differently when they experience mental health crises or behavioral issues, and the world still doesn't fully appreciate how to support them holistically, which of course includes their mental health. And an interest in social justice demands that we support all citizens and those abroad to live fulfilling, dignified, and healthy lives. So all of these things are political. And the thing I fight with my parents about is that they don't like when I say, oh, cancer is really political. They go, oh no, everyone should just be healthy. Because everyone wants everyone to be healthy. You can go to Tourette's hero Jess Tom's amazing blog and find out how the DWP and all of the changes to disability care in this country have affected her life. Okay? All of these things are political. My favorite word that is not used so much anymore, but it was really big about 10 years ago, was non-smoker's lung cancer. You used to hear it all the time. It was this amazing term. Has anyone ever heard non-smoker's lung cancer? That's a good cancer, right? That takes away victimness, right? An illness is an illness is an illness is an illness. Cancer is political, breast cancer is political, cervical, lung, bone cancer, bowel cancers, children's leukemia is also political. Mental health is political, PTSD is political, postnatal depression is political, HIV has always been political, so has abortion, ADHD is political, learning disabilities are political, neurodiversity is political, as is dementia, RAMPs are political, personal assistants are political, BSL interpretation is political. And the failure to recognize these illnesses and conditions as political has led to a crisis in the UK, in the NHS, which is of course now a public health crisis. But the underfunding of the NHS is not the only public health crisis. We have austerity as a public health crisis, white supremacy is a public health crisis, Brexit is a public health crisis, addiction is a public health crisis, toxic masculinity is a public health crisis. So if it's true that there is ever more funding, calls, and schemes for public health, which I think that there is, we need to be both intersectional and generous with how we define what falls into the world of health and well-being, and how viewing these crises through a political public health lens can help us address them in new ways. Two more minutes. Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay. Two things are true. When you are sick, you are not disconnected from a world which is increasingly difficult, racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, classist, etc. And when you are living in a world that is increasingly difficult, racist, sexist, transphobic, classist, regionalist, etc., you may have different health and well-being needs. That is true. And just finally, I'll just read what was the Sick of the Fringes, our little blurb is here, it's just one paragraph. The Sick of the Fringe originally looked at the body as autonomous. In 2019, we're looking at it in dialogue with the world in pain, societal injustice, and systems of oppression. Care and Destruction, the name of our festival, takes a broad-reaching theme and through this program has invited artists to look at unexpected ways of challenging and considering the negatives of care and the positives of destruction. This festival acts as a provocation, a launch of a long-term inquiry to open up and sustain conversations and introduce new critical voices. We are excited for the future and how by working to build communities around ideas, we can mobilize support, resistance, and understanding. Unhealthy care and necessary destruction. Rip it up, air the room, start again. That's where I'll leave it for now. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Brian. Fantastic. And can I ask Helen Victoria and Jane to join us as well. Okay, a great set of provocations and information and a whole heap of gaps and a whole heap of stuff. So who is going to come with the first comment or question, please? I assume... Oh, yes, you there. Can you say who you are and where you're from as well, please? And can you talk quite... In fact,
Georgia, would you mind?
Should we give one of those here?
Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Dougie Loney. I'm a senior consultant at BOP Consulting. We do a lot of research and evaluation, looking at arts and health and culture and the effects of culture. I think the thing that struck me across all of the contributions so far is this bind that we find ourselves in between trying to find and generate evidence and data that commissioners, in whatever guises they come in, will pay attention to. I do agree somewhat with what Brian said around we're trying to live in this kind of utopian evidence-based kind of policy environment, but actually in real life it's not quite like that. But at the same time, we do need to find some kind of middle ground, or we already occupy a middle ground, whereby we are able to support disruptive, innovative, different, challenging projects, interventions, and so on, but within the boundaries of, in which they will be supported by the bureaucratic sort of structures in which they're required. So I was just, yeah, the question is just, or sort of the sort of point there is just, are we actually okay where we are, or what needs to change in order to get beyond that particular hump?
What needs to change in a world where people don't care? First of all, I'm just going to go this way from you, Victoria.
I think the evidence question, it's a really difficult and interesting one. I think it is something to do with who you're creating the evidence for. I think I would argue that evidence can be about resistance that you're describing if it's designed in a way that is not completely craven to a system that you're objecting to. So I'm particularly interested in other forms of evidence, so how the arts can be, rather than being subject to assessment, can be the evidence themselves. As a lot of your performances, part of the Sick of the Fringe art, they are the evidence. That you don't need to then assess them and produce a paper. So I think it's partly about how you design it and who you're making it for, and if it's for you rather than for a kind of fantasy. Well, as Richard was saying, that we think that the Department of Health wants randomised controlled trials. That may not be true, but we sort of find ourselves in this kind of fantasy situation of creating evidence for an other that we don't really understand. So I think if we stop doing that, that's a step in the right direction, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's really about, I think the word resistance is really good. So for example, has anyone got any idea what the NHS recommendations are for evaluating social prescribing interventions? Any idea what the methodology is that they want us to use?
Nope.
Warwick Edinburgh Mental Wellbeing Scale. Mm. So a quantitative measure that was validated with 1,000 healthy psychology undergraduates at a very good university in the States. So not representative of a population which is then going to be social prescribing is seeking to support. So if we're not pushing these boundaries about what evidence is and how it's valued, those are the sorts of frameworks we're all going to, because that's just one area of operating in social prescribing. And NHS just wouldn't budge on it because it's supposedly easy to implement. Any of us could implement it. That's actually not true. I've been working with it for years and I can't implement it. All the different populations and individuals that I've worked with have found it difficult. And yet that is the national framework that is being recommended. So we really have to tackle this head on. And we've got to think about, as Victoria says, I think creative ways of how we can push that through different types of evidence and getting people to change their attitudes towards evidence.
I think we need a broader understanding of the community of knowledge that's grown up around this, the kind of experience of individual artists. There's a whole range of things from that robust evidence that we're supposedly providing right through to the evaluations. There's a very good repository of so-called, which is an interesting name, but grey literature down in Canterbury, which you can access, which has got international examples of evaluations and reports and strategies and things that don't pass that robust research test, but are actual active documents. They're actually about people's practice, what's actually happening in the world, and the big push is to make that understood at those higher government levels, I guess.
Jane, any
comments? Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned when I spoke that it's certainly an area that we need to better evidence in terms of the work that we want to do in Brighton and Hove, and the big question is how do we get that work done? Certainly the membership of the Living Well group, a lot of third sector organisations, who are those organisations who are on a daily basis
working with people and delivering amazing work, working with a whole range of people within the city and doing fantastic things. But also part of their role has to be capture those successes and how can they use that information I think Brian mentioned how do we move that evidence upwards so it actually has an impact further up, particularly in terms of that funding that those organisations desperately need to continue their work.
Did you want to add?
Yeah, I was just thinking that one of the problems with evaluation and thinking about the art itself as the evaluation, etc., is that you have to align the people who are making the work and the people who are needing evaluation to fund the work to, at the same exact time, change their opinion about the value of evaluation, right? Like you need to say, I value qualitative data, at a time when the funders say, we value qualitative data. Because unless they happen in line, then the person who needs the money, who needs the funding, is always going to go to the standard of what they're told is taken. So it just feels, it's a bit chicken and egg.
I was rather struck by the Grey Literature's All in Canterbury remark, because, I mean, in some ways I think as well, there is this sort of sense in which, you know, we don't necessarily know where the data is, where it lives, what it looks like, and very sort of basic things like just good, robust case studies that can live all over the place, not just in Canterbury, probably in Brighton and all over the place. So I think there's a really big issue here as well, and this is not pertinent only to this specific field, but I think is one that kind of is one of the messes across the entire public sector, you know, we could argue, is this very sense of making sense of the evidence, where it lives, how it's accessed, who creates it, and for what reason. I know we've got people in the room here who do a lot of work around values, for example, who might contribute to this conversation later, values as a mode of evaluation. So, but without further ado, I just want to open up to...
Just that one thing. I can give you the link to that.
Give it to them.
Great Literature. So
yes.
You get it.
Give it to the group. It's on that site too.
Yeah.
Good. Now, other questions. So we've talked a little bit about evidence. I know there's white elephants in the room all over the place. You.
Georgia, is the mic... So I think it's best maybe if we keep one on the floor and one up here, on the other floor. Yes, sorry.
Thank you. I'm Donald. I'm from the Guildhall School. I'm a music therapist.
Yeah.
I sort of have a professional title as an artist in health, if you like,
yeah.
And from a perhaps professionalised discipline and perhaps over-professionalised, but also one that if it had been reliant on evidence-based practice, the profession would not exist. And although there are now projects that have researched the evidence of art therapies, they've had the same problems that I think everyone's had, you know, getting figures. I wanted to just say that to be here, because I've heard the word therapy come up a couple of times, and there seems to be a sort of inverted commas around it, or some doubt about it. It is part of the system, very much picking up on, you know, that I work for the NHS, you know, I take instruments into an acute psychiatric ward once a week, and, well, something happens, and some weeks it sounds good, and some weeks it sounds awful, you know, but some weeks people say, you know, why is this only once a week? Why don't we have it more? So I see good things happening, but I also don't want to put it out there. I mean, could we talk about therapy, and how does it relate to arts and health? And could we also think about perhaps the NHS language, the PREMS as well as the PROMS, the patient-reported experience as well as the patient-reported outcome? So it's a comment.
Great.
Glad to hear your thoughts.
Thank you very much, Donald. Helen, I'm going to pass to you. Would you like to respond?
I can. Donald can correct me, or others in the room. Just in terms of the difference. So when we're talking about arts and health, we're referring to both formal qualifications like dance therapists, music therapists, art therapists who are professionally accredited. In fact, VAT, which is Association of Art Therapists, literally in the building, three doors down. And Donald can tell you about those sorts of accreditations and what sorts of work they do, but then through to the huge range of practice that we've already heard. And so that again has been the challenge. Like you say, many of the therapies have sprung up through professional accredited courses without that evidence base. And indeed, things like, so in terms of the national rollout of social prescribing, arts on prescription is the largest area of social prescribing, but it's received the smallest amount of funding, whereas exercise on prescription, which has only really been going for quite a long time, but certainly not the longevity that arts on prescription has, because it's obvious that exercise is good for you, and there's a ton of evidence that says that physical activity is good for you. It's automatically assumed that CCGs and referrers will want to prescribe in that area. And yet we already have a massive evidence base that we know the value of arts impact. So it's just understanding why that commissioning gap happens. And that's just one area. We're talking about all those other areas where we're not talking about commissioning. So individual organisations working with third sectors, individuals, artists and practitioners working to support people in the community. And that's why, for me, I think about the asset-based approach. I work a lot with parks and what people are doing in parks, green spaces, and how, because I'm actually a biodiversity person, how nature is valued. And they have very, very similar discussions about how we can value the environment better and how we can change people's lives to value the environment more closely. And it always comes down to evidence. So I think we've just got to... I'm sorry to keep coming back to that. But, yeah. I don't know if that answered your question.
Any other... Oh, yes, there's a woman at the back there. Thank you.
Hello, I'm June Stevenson. I'm from the Artists Foundation. And should I stand up? We work with primary school age children doing performing arts, and I sort of feel a bit encouraged, Helen, by what you're saying, because we've tried to use the Warwick Edinburgh's little sister, if you like, the Stirling scale, in our evaluation over the last year, and it's really difficult. And I sort of feel like, as a small charity with not much capacity, I sort of now think, oh, I should have maybe held my nerve and just stuck to evaluating in the way that we're all about confidence for children and their communication skills and their sense of self-worth. And actually, our own way we measure that is really satisfying. But it's we sort of went off down the Stirling scale because we thought we need to speak that language that health people will respond well to. I'm now thinking, I think it might not have actually served us that well. We haven't finished collecting all that evidence, but it's been surprisingly difficult to use. So I suppose my question, if there is one, is just, as a smaller organisation that's trying to have an impact, can people like me sort of sit back and say, other researchers will do the evidence and we can just do our own thing? Or should I really be leaning in and trying to find the next validated approach and trying harder? Sort of a question.
That's a really, really interesting question. Well, I'm sure lots of us want to respond to that. There's also perhaps a point here that maybe Richard might want to pick up on. Are there methods that, for example, Arts Council are looking at that might be more tried and tested than others? I want to just put this, I know Victoria wanted to respond to this. You no, yes?
I can,
okay.
Wait if you want
to. Would you like to say word first, Richard,
and then I'll pass over?
Well, as I think I started to say at the end, really, is that the Arts Council might want to ask different kinds of research questions. And just really from my report, there is a relatively little research examining the creative practice itself, what such projects might offer beyond measurable signs of desistance in the case of criminal justice, or recovery in the case of health and so on, what art and culture it might produce, what impact it might have on artists' own practice, and in the case of criminal justice, what impact it might have on their families and communities, but that also applies to the health as well, of course, and the wider audiences that this work can sometimes reach. It's a very thin, when you look at it, there's an awful lot of papers out there, research papers, and there's an awful lot of measurement tools out there, and they don't really seem to produce any interesting human information sometimes, and I think that is a real challenge. So we have run a research grants program in the past, and there's some really exciting projects being funded through it in a number of areas, including arts and health, a really interesting one around which got brilliant results of the impact of singing on women suffering from post. Yes, thank you. But they were, in a way, they were very, and I know Helen was involved in with it, but in a way they were a little bit like what's already happening, or should be happening, out in the higher education world. And we might be looking at a different approach, maybe, to look at some of the things that Brian had raised in his presentation, which I thought was brilliant, about, you know, getting away from the nice bits. I think that's great. And the fact it is political, and the fact a lot of artists are driven by social justice, and just clinging to an arts for art's sake argument is not a way of dealing with that.
Okay, so we still have an issue with methods, best methods for evaluation for projects like yours. And I think that's something for us to take from this. I'm aware that we're over time, unless there's any... Oh, yes, just a quick question. You could...
Hello, my name...
Yes?
My name's Abigail. I'm a visual artist working to make the menopause visible. Menopause is political. And I want to respond to Brian's point about it's the government, it is the government's job not to traumatise people. How are we going to work to make this sick organisation better? Because much as we don't want to do ourselves out of jobs, when we can get funding to pay ourselves to do the work we feel so passionate about, actually, are we looking at the problem? Are we dealing with the cancerous cell, and should we be looking at that?
And what would a strategy for that look like? Brian, I'm just going to have to ask you to answer that.
No, everyone is doing as much as they can. Everyone that's working in an arts organization is doing as much as they can. Everyone that's working in a non-profit organization is doing as much as they can. And it can't be said enough. We're not living in a moment where that work is valued and appreciated for the emotional labor that is happening by probably everyone in this room that is really engaged in those questions. So I think, no. That's what I think.
I think, if it's okay, we're going to sort of stop there, hold that. Thank you for a brilliant point. We are almost at 4 o'clock. I'm going to suggest we should now be at 20 to 4, but hey ho. Can I suggest we take a quick comfort break, just have a cup of tea, pop to the loo, loo's downstairs, and then come reconvene in 10 minutes at 4:10. So thank you to all our lovely panellists.